This meeting of the House Transportation Committee can now come to order. It is now 1:02 p.m. on Thursday, January 30th, 2025, here in Capitol Room 124. Our members present are Representative McCabe, Representative Moore, Representative Mina, my co-chair, Representative Eichheit, and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business, and please take this time to silence your cell phones. Before we get started, I'll thank Suniva St. Clair from House Records, Doug Bridges from the Juno LIO for staffing our committee today, as well as our committee aide and my staff, Griffin Sakeu. On today's agenda, we have an overview of rural airports from our Director of Statewide Aviation, Troy LaRue. And after that presentation, which I hope to take about half an hour to an hour of our time at most, we will then be picking up where we left off from earlier this week with continued question and answer time and finishing out our presentation on the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program with Deputy Commissioner Catherine Keith and Program Administrator Dom Pannone. So I will go ahead and welcome to our committee Mr. LaRue, if you could come on up to the dais and introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and start your presentation.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I appreciate being here. My name is Troy LaRue, and I am the Division's Operations Manager for Statewide Aviation for the Department of Transportation. So as we look at our mission statements, the department's mission statement is Keep Alaska Moving Through Services and Infrastructure. As we look at the Airport International System, it's to keep Alaska flying and thriving, and Statewide Aviation to sustain and improve the quality of life throughout Alaska. Our two systems are report up in two different directions. The international system reports up to the commissioner's office, and the rural aviation system reports through the deputy commissioner's office. Today we're going to talk more about statewide aviation as it is my forte, and I understand that you'll be able to get an international airport system briefing later. As we look at the rural system here in Alaska, as you impose it over the map of the United States, you can see that we have a lot of challenges as we stretch all the way from San Francisco and up next to Michigan into Wisconsin and down to Florida. We have a lot of airports, and 82% of our communities live off the road system and are dependent on aviation. So without aviation, they're not going to get their milk, they're not going to get their medicine, and definitely not going to be able to come back and forth from their community. So very, very vital that we have aviation here in Alaska. We actually sort of joke to our federal partners who we have a very good relationship with, and we say, you know, you can't build Alaska back better because you haven't started building us yet. As we look at our operating cost for the rural aviation system, it's just under $50 million. And as you look at our revenue streams, we really only have two. We have some fuel tax and some leasing. So at $11.8 million in revenue and just under $50 in cost, then you wonder, how do we sustain this huge vital system? And we're always looking for efficiencies and cost reductions where we can find them. And it's really, really difficult as inflation is rising. So we're looking at sand and chemical optimization. I can tell you that sand sometimes can be extremely hard to find locally at some of our airports. It kind of sounds weird, but it is. You have to have the right gradation. And if you don't, you could damage an aircraft. We're finding that with the temperature swings that are happening today, we're leaning on chemical a whole lot more so that we can decontaminate our runways and keep them safe. The other thing that we're doing is we've found some avenues to perform a lot of our maintenance activities on the federal dollar instead of general fund. So that's helped us a lot. Workforce challenges for us today are staffing and training. If you have a person at an airport, they have to wear about 7 to 10 hats here in Alaska versus a different airport. in the lower 48. So they have to be an operations expert. They have to be an equipment operator. They have to know security. They have to know how to inspect the airfield and to report the conditions. They have to know how to be an aircraft firefighter. They also have to be a medical trauma technician. So all of these things take a vast amount of training. And we do have some really, really superb equipment operators that are like, hey, I just as soon run a grader on the highway. I don't want to do all the rest of that stuff at the airport. And we appreciate those folks too. But it is very, very challenging.
Mr. LaRue, we have a couple questions. Representative McCabe.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. LaRue, I'm interested in talking about sand and chemicals, and especially with respect to Big Lake Airport, which is an airport real close to me, and that I get constant complaints about, because in the last 3 weeks, it's not been sanded or chemical treated. Actually, in the last month, it's not been sanded or chemical treated that I know of once, and I've probably got a dozen phone calls. And I tell those guys continually that sand and chemicals are probably not going to happen on Big Lake Airport because of the corrosive and because of the composition of the sand. I know that you're not really doing it. It's the DOT MNO from Palmer, and I know that they're busy with the rest of the roads. But maybe you could describe a little bit the difference to me between a real rural airport that's off the road system and who maintains that and where they get the sand and chemicals, and the Big Lake Airport that Palmer MNO can actually reach if they have spare time, apparently.
Sure. Through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe. When we look at the rural aviation system, we have 26 Part 139 airports that are paved and have commercial traffic. The Big Lake Airport doesn't have commercial traffic, although they do have a pretty good GA community there. So on the bigger airports that are paved, we must use sand and chemicals in order to get the friction coefficiency that we need in order to bring those aircraft in. At Big Lake, there are much smaller aircraft. You're working on a gravel airfield. And so what we're trying to do there a lot of times in the winter is to reshape the runway and to keep it clear. But I can tell you that when you have a highway crew that is trying to take care of both the highway and the airport at the same time, I think it's a massive challenge for those folks. And every once in a while, they are noting the airport as closed or unattended while they're trying to clear the highway, and then they come back to the airport.
Follow up? Thanks. So kind of along those lines, you mentioned NOTAM closed, and I don't know, maybe 2 years ago we had a discussion, the DOT and I did, about a airport dashboard so that pilots would have a quicker route. So by the time you, and for NOTAM, those that don't know, it's notices to airmen, and it's the FAA way that they close and open airports that are FAA-approved airports. And we've had a number of accidents in Big Lake because the NOTAM didn't get transmitted either from DOT or from the FAA. There seems to be a disconnect there. So point being is we had a discussion about a dashboard for airports that the local pilots could go to and say, hey, can I go to Big Lake? Or maybe it's not been plowed yet, or at least have a description of what, because oftentimes it's hard to tell from the air. So are we still working on that dashboard, do you know, or is that in the works, a possibility, or what?
Through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, I love this question. Yes, we're working on many, many different dashboards. One of the most recent ones, as we're harnessing AI now to then do the data mining of the NOTAM systems and other data mining, we're able then to build a dashboard that will eventually be able to tell the post office that we have a runway closed so that they know that the bypass mail isn't going to make it in there that day. We have several of these tasks. As this one, we have a dashboard right now that will tell you what the status is of all automated weather systems, whether they're National Weather Services or they belong to the FAA. We plan to expand these dashboards over this next year in a big way, and I'll be looking forward to this question again next year.
Thank you. Mr. Lieber, we have a question from Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the Chair, Mr. LaRue, on the very last bullet you had on that slide, workforce challenges, staffing, and training, briefly, can you talk about those challenges I'd be interested in a vacancy rate, and what are you doing, and what do you need to be fully staffed on your workforce?
Through the co-chairs, co-chair Eichscheid, I like this question too. I can tell you that we went through a pretty rough collective bargaining session this last year, and a lot of our equipment operators, they were very much waiting for a wage adjustment, and that has happened. So I think that we're able to recruit a little bit better than we were before that. Also, when it comes to training, because of the connectivity, the advancement in technology and connectivity, we're now able to actually do video training with our folks where we weren't able to do it before. And that has really, really changed our lives. The other thing that we're doing with workforce development is we're bringing people up from different organizations to hold peer exchanges so that our folks can have a chance to actually look at a different perspective from somebody else. And then we're also doing some job sharing. We had some pretty tremendous weather here in western Alaska. You know, Nome and Kotze have been hit really hard. And their climate has changed a little bit there, where it's more of a coastal climate than it used to be. And so we've had to pivot with those changes in climate on resource development and then training for that.
Follow-up?
The vacancy rate,
sir. You know, I wish I had that for you. I'm not sure what the vacancy rate is today, only that I know that it's been improving.
If you wouldn't mind getting that to the committee as a follow-up, I appreciate that.
We'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
And Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, Mr. LaRue, I'm staying on that subject a little bit. What kind of exit interview or data gathering? I know this really isn't your purview because you're focused on little airports, or I shouldn't say little, but rural airports, if you will, and not personnel. That's kind of not your job. But do you know of any kind of a data or exit surveys you do for your rural airport folks in Buckland and other places that are maintaining the airport? If somebody quits, do you typically know why he quit there in the village? I know it's not even close to your purview. I don't even know why we're on this subject here. But
through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, you know, we definitely try to talk to folks on their way out the door because we do want to make work life better. If we can improve anything, we want to do that. Our workforce is the backbone of our safety, so we need to have them. A lot of times when people are leaving, they're leaving because they're going to a higher paying job, and I think that that's been the bigger trend than anything else.
Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. LaRue, feel free to continue.
So as we look at our federal capital funding, which is really important, this is a snapshot of the last 5 years. You can see in the first 2 years, we didn't have the bipartisan infrastructure legislation that we enjoy today. When we did get bipartisan infrastructure legislation funding, we all thought, man, we're going to do so many more projects than we ever did. But inflation ate us. And so what we've been able to do is deliver pretty much what we had programmed before. We are enjoying right now a 5% match for the program, and we will through 26. Historically, it's been 6.25% match, unless it's an essential air service airport. The essential air service program is very, very strong here in Alaska. We have over 60 essential air service routes that are worth over $40 million. So those are seat subsidies that help Alaskans get to their location. This is just another snapshot of the 5-year rural system capital funding. As we look at the program and the federal proportions, we have to remember that we have two systems still. So you can see what the rural system is spending in capital improvement dollars and what the AIAS system is spending. Now, this is just federal dollars. You have to remember that the international system has other revenue streams that help them fund their programs.
And Mr. LaRue, just for my edification, can you define AIAS and AIP and BIL for us? It's through the, acronym through
the,
heavy.
Through the co-chairs, and please forgive me. Deputy Commissioner Keith and I fixed some of these slides here yesterday, and we just didn't get it done in time in order to make the deck here. But yes, AIAS is the Alaska International Airport System, which includes Fairbanks International and Anchorage International. So AIP would be the Airport Improvement Program that comes through the federal government.
And we have a question. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Can we back up just a little bit? Because I think that maybe the public needs to understand the essential air service. Once again, I know it's a little bit outside of your your management of the rural airports, but essential air service, we've heard a number of times the federal delegation, Senator Murkowski and Senator Sullivan, defending essential air service in Alaska. And I don't think people really understand what it is and how much it contributes to our keeping those runways open, number one, but also to our ability to move around the state and people to move cheaply into the villages. And so maybe you could give us a brief recap or thumbnail on what essential air service is.
Through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, yes, absolutely. And we do follow EAS, Essential Air Service, very, very closely and have promoted it in a lot of ways. The Essential Air Service Program was adopted, I believe, when Ronald Reagan was the president and we went through deregulation. There was a point in time where the federal government, if you wanted to fly from Seattle to Reagan, D.C., they would say, okay, but you have to pick up these other communities in order to be approved for this route. Well, one day they went, you know what, this isn't the way capitalism's supposed to work, and we want to get out of the way. So they went through a process called deregulation. If you had air service when deregulation hit, then you were eligible to join the Essential Air Service Program, and that would allow you to subsidize your route. So if we didn't have the Essential Air Service Program, there would be people paying a tremendous amount of money for seats. And the routes come clear up through Southeast, Cordova, into Anchorage. They go as far out as Adak, believe it or not. But, we have over 60 communities that are served with Essential Air Service. And I want to say it's $41 million.
Follow up. So, and the $41 million is federally subsidized. I mean, they provide that subsidy so that, say, somebody that a native that lives in Adak or even Dutch Harbor or outside of Dutch Harbor, a villager, can get there on a seat fare cheaply rather than having to charter an entire airplane because we're subsidizing the air service that goes there so that those seats are available. Is that kind of it in a nutshell?
It is. And, you know, the last community that just became eligible happened after reauthorization was signed, and that's Chenega. And Chenega wasn't at their location when the deregulation hit because of the earthquake. And so then they weren't eligible for EAS because they weren't in their community. And through our delegation in D.C., we were able to add them back to the list. And so they will definitely be receiving essential air service here shortly. The other airport that we're waiting for the award to be announced is Seward. And so that'll bring commercial service back to the Seward Airport. The Seward Airport's been very difficult as far as capital improvement goes because they haven't had the critical design type aircraft needed to justify the runway length that the community would like. Through this last round of reauthorization, we believe we're going to have a way different conversation with our federal partners now than we've been able to have before. So not only will Seward receive essential air service, I think here in the future they're going to get some relief on what the community desires for their airfield.
Thanks.
Thank you. Please continue. Oh, sorry. We had another question from Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair, I had a question. Is the previous five-year rural system capital funding, and you mentioned that a lot of the bipartisan infrastructure law monies that we got were eaten up by inflation, but you know, as I look at this, you know, I see federal fiscal year 2022. You know, I can see the numbers there, but you know, I kind of know where the inflation graph is. You know, it's been coming down. Of course, you know, it doesn't mean costs come down, just the rate of increases. So I understand that, but between 2021 and 2022, there's a difference of approximately over $70 million, which that's a big jump. I assume inflation didn't eat all that because it far exceeds the inflation rate. Can you just it seems like a good thing. Can you explain a little bit about that bump in funding and what it was used yes. for? Because it seems significantly high.
Through the co-chairs, Representative Eichheit, what happens at the end of every federal fiscal year is there is discretionary dollars that the FAA allocates. And those are entitlement dollars that other states or other airport sponsors weren't able to utilize within their five-year program. And so when those discretionary – and I have another slide on that. But when those discretionary dollars flow to us, sometimes we do see a pretty good uptick in AIP funding.
So just a follow-up comment.
Follow-up.
So we did have some significant monies there. I mean, it wasn't just inflation kept it level. We actually had a significant bump with those extra dollars.
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay. I assume good things happened with that.
I promise you they did.
Thank you.
All right. Please continue.
All right. So I think our biggest challenge here in Alaska as we try to deliver the program is the slow rollout in grants. And what the federal government has done here recently is they're working on continuing resolutions. So at the end of a federal reauthorization for airports, we could hopefully see 5 years of funding. The AIP program is only in its stage today was built in 1982. I only know of twice that we've ever had 5 years of federal funding. The last time was when President Trump signed the last reauthorization in 2018. So we're kind of hoping that our federal program is going to be pretty solid going through this year. But as we look at 84% of our grants happened in September, that's really, really tough for us because we're missing a whole construction season. If we don't have a barge secured by about February or March, we're not going to build an airport that summer. So it's really hamstrung us. And as we're working with the FAA, we have a lot of different ideas of maybe how we can fix that here in the future. And I'll have some more slides to speak to that as well. So here's a snapshot from 2018 to 2024, and you can just see how many grants were executed during those years. As you saw some of the funding streams from previous years, you'll notice that we weren't necessarily underfunded, but when you're looking at some of those lower grant numbers, those are just bigger projects. And when you're building $50, $60, $70 million projects, then you're going to have less grants out. I think as you look at those higher numbers, what you're also recognizing is that we've really ramped up the M&O program in the federal airport improvement program in order to execute the maintenance projects that we really need to do. And let's face it, general funding is getting harder and harder to come by. So pivoting to the federal program and leveraging those dollars has really helped us. These are the upcoming projects that we're looking at, advertising. I think that all of them need to happen, and we're just excited to see this capital improvement program moving.
Mr. LaRue, are these projects in any particular order?
They really aren't in any particular order.
Okay, thank you.
So if you look at our projects that are underway and up and coming, they're kind of in three different buckets. State of good repair, as you look at Chenega Bay and Dead Horse and Quetzalcoatl and Buckland, and these are all safety projects that we want to make sure happen quickly and that will keep our airfields safe. And as we look at rural access, that's really economic vitality for a lot of these communities. So we put these communities in that bucket. And then when it comes to sustainability We're looking at the Ketchikan terminal and the Sitka terminal as terminal projects that we haven't been able to do in the past and support in the past. But then we're also looking at generators and snow removal equipment buildings. And I apologize again for the acronyms that are up there.
Mr. LaRue, question from Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Mr. LaRue, through the chair, Mr. LaRue, maybe flesh out for those that are listening what it takes for you to do a project. So, I remember when Buckland was a 1,500-foot strip, and I actually flew a C-130, several C-130s in there in the winter and landed on the frozen river to drop off the equipment that was going to be used 6 months later to lengthen the runway to where it is now. So I don't think the public quite understands necessarily what it takes for the DOT to do one of these projects in a remote airport that has no road service, and we're going to get into that in a little bit when we talk about how you get these expensive graders into the places. But run through a typical project like Buckland or Chivac or somewhere off the road system and the planning it takes and the time period it takes and how you have to kind of do it, and I think it would be helpful.
Sure. Through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, I enjoy your questions. I'll use Kipnick as an example since it's a project that was just completed. It took probably, I want to say, 4 years of planning it before we could execute the project. Environmental is one of the big challenges that we have right now, and we have a really great team of people that I think are excelling at delivering our environmental side of these projects. But in Kipnuk, you have to bring your barge in the summertime. You have to unload all of your gravel, all of your equipment, every stick of material that you're going to use. And then you're waiting for winter so that you can build an ice road. And now you're moving all of your stuff in on that ice road and staging it so that next spring you can start building the airport. And generally, those are about a 3 to 4 year process. Again, we only have 4 years to execute our grant, our construction grant. So we really have to have our ducks in a row in order to deliver these projects.
Follow up? Thanks. So I know that the FAA is aware because most of them are here, but when you go to the federal delegation or when you go to Washington, D.C., and you describe these challenges that you have, which are similar to what the DOT has in Alaska, the roadside DOT, do you have like a presentation that you give them to describe Kipnuk, say, and building an ice road and why it takes so long and why you can't, like in Arizona, just go, or somewhere in the South Texas, and you just go and bulldoze a runway and lay some gravel and call it good? It seems like Alaska has significantly bigger challenges. So point being is, do you describe these or Commissioner Anderson or whoever describe these to help us with the FAA funding? The four-year threshold, and this is where I'm going with this, the four-year funding cycle is a problem for us because of that, right?
Through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, absolutely. And, not only do we drive this home when we're able to go to D.C. and meet with our congressional delegates, and they're very, very effective, but we invite our federal partners out here every year, and we say, if you come out in the summertime, we know that you appreciate us, but if you come out in the wintertime, we know you're committed. And what we really like to do is we like to make sure that our federal partners get here to Alaska, that they get out to some of these rural communities, and that they have some boots on the ground and some real realization of what's happening. There's a cookie-cutter approach to most things that happen with the federal government, and we don't fit within that cookie.
Thanks.
Thank you. Please continue.
So as we look at how we generate our federal dollars, we generate some of them through cargo entitlements. And believe me, we have a lot of cargo that flows through Alaska. So we really do enjoy some good federal funding there. And then there's primary passenger entitlement, which is over 10,000 emplanements in that community per year. So we're earning roughly about $31.6 million off of primary entitlements, and then another $24.3 million off of the non-primary, which would be less than 10,000 enplanements. We have state apportionment, which is based on population and land mass. We don't earn a lot off of population, but we do really well off of land mass. And then we have Alaska Supplemental. And what Alaska Supplemental is when the AIP program, the Airport Improvement Program, as it is today, was built in 1982, we had Alaska Supplemental called out in the old program, and we've been able to enjoy that going forward. So, and then this last year, we talked about discretionary a little bit too. $95.5 million is what we received in discretionary. And that was able to do a couple of really important projects. Nightmute Airport was one of them, and then the Anchorage on the north side, they had a $21.7 million project. And then supplemental discretionary are just special additional GAF, general fund appropriations that the FAA gets to decide where they go, and a lot of that goes to noise compatibility. So FAA reauthorization, we really, really enjoyed this last round of reauthorization, and I can tell you that all three of our congressional delegates rolled their sleeves up, and they worked really hard on this. Last reauthorization was 2018, and the state of Alaska did very well in it. But what we realized in 2018 is we didn't ask for enough. So we worked at it a lot harder. The state of Alaska was mentioned 37 times in reauthorization. No other state was mentioned more than twice. So you can tell how hard our congressional delegates worked for us. One of the things that we've been trying to push is there is a request form for cold weather states for early starts. Nobody's ever been able to use the thing. So it's been very difficult. In our recent conversations with our local FAA region, they're thinking that maybe we could do a advertisement and MOB cost for a first year and then go into a construction cycle maybe for 4 years after that. So I can tell you that they're very, very interested in trying to make sure that we get the construction window that we really need in order to complete our projects. There'll be a lot more discussions taking place on this one as we go forward. And there's other cold weather states that kind of want a Me Too thing. The problem is they have roadways that go to their airports and we don't. So I think we are very, very unique, even though there's folks in D.C. that are tired of hearing that.
Mr. LaRue, question from Representative McCabe.
Thanks. I actually have two questions. One of them is for Representative Stutz. Recognize the airport in the picture?
Well, I was kind of looking.
It's Old Harbor.
It is.
Yeah, that was
a comment. Representative Stutz.
I got you.
Thank you. Yeah, that was really an effort of love, building that airport. What was it? The military came in.
IRT.
Yes. It was really incredible. I was fortunate enough to go and see him cut the ribbon on it. That was pretty exciting.
Having operated out of both airports, I can tell you that that was one of the best safety improvements in Kodiak in a decade. It was, made it so much different. So my question is on the cold weather early start. Is that specifically for Alaska for the most part because of our construction, like we talked about earlier, trying to fit us into the four-year funding cycle, if you will?
Through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, this law and this form has been on the books for a long time, and we've tried to leverage it. We've tried to use the form. Nobody knows how. And so now we're looking for a different avenue to make sure that our needs are met.
Cool. Thanks.
Please continue.
So Section 332 talks about automated weather systems. And the FAA in the past, if you can get a hold of their data, their metrics for how their automated systems are working aren't very transparent. So we built our own dashboard. And within our dashboard, we're able to show them our definition of an outage is the pilot can't get the weather information. Their definition or their metrics are different, and there's reasons for that. But all we care about is can you get the weather and can you use that weather to land? And And that's what we want to look at. Now, they are having this same struggle in the lower 48, believe it or not. And so when we started talking dashboards nationally, everybody got on board with that too and said, yeah, we don't like the way that this is working. I see weather changing a lot with an acceptable aviation weather changing a lot here in the future. I don't believe that there are going to be AWOSs and ASOSs, these very expensive units out there in the future. I believe that technology has surpassed what's out in the field today, and that we're going to see not only a reduction in the cost. It costs $2 million to build an AWOS here in Alaska, but you can get some pretty good approved weather for about $100,000. So, you know, we don't really want to build $2 million weather systems anymore.
Representative McCabe.
So maybe we could flesh that out a little bit for the public and for those on the committee that don't understand. The ASOS and the AWOS are weather reporting that a pilot must have before he can file for instrument flying to go into a certain airport. So if I were to take a Part 135 or 121 instrument flight rule airplane into a Part 139 airport or even an airport with an approach, for me to file that, I have to have a certain weather from one hour before to 1 hour after, and I have to be able to have the weather reporting and the predicting and all that. And it comes from these things, the $2 million things. Most pilots these days, they just go on the weather cams that our DOT has put up, and the FAA has put up some weather cams, and they look at the weather and they say, oh, I think I can get in there, right? But legally, they still have to have this, which is we're hamstrung with the FARs, the regulations, and these $2 million things. So I think that's what you're talking about. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you're talking about a FAR change to ease the requirement for AWOS and ASOS and let the pilots use a different reporting system.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. Right. Representative Stutes.
Thank you. I find that interesting. Thank you for the explanation on that, because I'm not quite sure. So in Yakutat a couple years ago, the pilots couldn't land. They said, I can look down, I can see the runway, it's clear as a bell, but they weren't allowed to land. So how do you get around that?
Through the co-chairs, Representative Stutes, I like this question too. This last fall, Senator Murkowski was in Cordova and on her way to Yakutat, and she couldn't go to Yakutat because the weather service was out, okay? So she immediately got on the phone and started calling people, and once you know it, about a month later, there was 30 of us standing on that ASOS platform in Yakutat talking about what do we do about this weather instrumentation system that's not working. And everybody's like, well, you know, it's going to be replaced in 2 years. And she goes, okay, what are we going to do in the next 2 years? And they said, well, most of it is due to some thready power that's available in the community. And we said, well, let's put some power refreshers on there then so that we make sure that they have good power. And then somebody said, well, that's economically prohibitive. And she said, what does that mean? And the more we started talking, the National Weather Service said, you know, we have what's called a MAS unit, M-A-S. And I wish I could tell you what that stands for, but it is a new approved weather system that I believe has just been installed in Yakutat. And the other thing that we want to do in Yakutat is we kind of want to have a weather shootout. There are so many other technology-driven weather systems out there that are so great, that are affordable. Some of them are even deployed right now in Alaska, and we want to see every weather technology available here in Alaska.
Follow up? Thank you. Thank you for that. So, but there is no workaround. It's
They're making new regulation to where these weather systems will be available. As a matter of fact, the FAA is testing a new one in Palmer right now that's a visual automated weather system. And so it's it's a fraction of the price of the other systems that they've promoted in the past. But there's been a real disconnect when it comes to approved weather, because everybody wants to say FAA certified weather. And in our conversations with the National Weather Service and the FAA, we're finding out that there really is no certified weather. It's whether it's approved for aviation or not. And we're finding that there's a lot of weather out there that should be approved for aviation that hasn't been in the past, and that's changing rapidly today. We're putting another unit on top of our building in Anchorage right now that will be monitoring weather both at Lake Hood and Anchorage International to compare it with the weather that's coming through at Anchorage International.
Follow up?
My last one, I promise, for temporarily anyway. Are they, you said there's weather that should be approved that isn't approved. Would that have anything to do with maybe the type of airplanes now as opposed to what they used to be?
Through the co-chairs, Representative Stutz, yes, that's actually accurate. They don't want the big 121 operators maybe testing these systems out. They would like a little smaller aircraft to do it. I personally would trust my life to most of the weather systems that are being tested in Alaska today.
Interesting. And Representative McCabe.
So a little bit different than those of us in Kodiak where you used to call up Yuzinki and say, hey, what's the weather look like? Can you see the top of the church?
Exactly.
I flew a lot into Anaktuvik Pass and had an ASOS with visibility reporting. Unfortunately, a guy built his house kind of right next to the ASOS, and when the wind was just right and he would light a fire or his heater would be going, the smoke would cover the ASOS and give you a 0-0 visibility. You could be able to see the tops of the mountains all the way to the north slope, but you couldn't go there because the visibility said 0-0 because whoever owned the house there had turned on his furnace. And hopefully we're getting past that with some of the newer stuff and the cameras and the, you know, and we're also getting past the window weather reports from Yuzinki. Remember, never call the person that you're picking up because right. The weather's always going to be great.
All right. That was fascinating, and I just learned an awful lot. Please continue.
So the FAA published the FAA Alaska Safety Initiative in 2017, I believe. This last reauthorization, it has now been renamed the Don Young Alaska Safety Initiative. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of goals that have been set up for this, like reducing fatal accidents by 90% by 2033. We have a strategic plan that are folding a lot of these goals in as well. So one thing that people probably don't realize is that if you take all of the mid-air collisions that happen in the United States, 44% of them happen in Alaska. That is a big number, and it's a bad number, and it's one that we want to aggressively change. So right now, the FAA has to report up to Congress every year on the development of the Don Young Alaska Safety Initiative. The other big thing that happened with reauthorization that I wanted to foot stomp is how the funding is used at our airport runways now. Senator Stevens, many years ago when the Runway Safety Initiative was taking place, was worried that we were going to shorten our runways in order to gain runway safety areas at the end. So he put in a law that basically states that Alaska doesn't have to shorten its runways in order to achieve runway safety areas. Now, that worked really great for a few years, and then the FAA said, well, all right, but we don't have to fund then the reconstruction of that runway. If you want to reconstruct that runway, you're going to have to shorten it or narrow it. So in this section now, it prohibits the FAA from restricting funding from being used at airports in Alaska to rehabilitate, resurface, or reconstruct the full length and width. So this was kind of a big win for us. Now, as I talked to the FAA, they're like, Troy, we still want to know why. And I'm like, oh, all right, the law's not good enough. And they're like, well, no, the law is good enough, but we want to be able to tell Alaska's story in D.C. And so if it's because you need to deliver fuel to that village and it won't meet the 500 operations for that critical design type aircraft, that's an important piece of information that still needs to be captured. Or if you're trying to do a fish haul and it's still not going to meet the 500 ops, that's still an economic driver. And we want to know why. And I don't think that's unreasonable. So we're working closely with our federal partners to tell them why. The AIP handbook is really what's hamstrung us. It was adopted in 2014, and it kept restricting our eligibility in many different areas. Before the AIP handbook, we had advisory circulars through the FAA, and they were just that, advisory. But with the adoption of the AIP handbook, they also adopted a rule that says if you've put any federal money into your airport, now these advisory circulars are regulatory, and they were never written to be regulatory, and it's really, really hurt us. So the other thing that happened is, next thing you know, not only Alaska's eligibility suffered, but a lot of eligibility in the lower 48 suffered, and everybody's like, well, why wasn't there a public process to adopt this AIP handbook? And we've talked to the FAA for many years about can we open this discussion again? And they're ready to do that. In our recent discussions, they're like, you know, with Alaska being mentioned 37 times and all of these different exemptions and exceptions that Alaska's looking for, maybe Alaska needs to have their own AIP handbook so that we don't have all of these appendices that go through the AIP handbook that's published today. But I can tell you that FAA now has agreed that they will, in the next 3 years, open up the AIP handbook. They will start a public process, and it will be revised. And I know that there's a lot of states in the lower 48 that are looking for relief as well. So we're not alone.
Mr. LaRue, we have a question from Representative Stutes.
Thank you. And I don't know if this is really pertinent to what you're saying, but isn't there something going on with the fuel mixture, too, that Alaska was looking for an exemption on of some sort? And does that fall into this category?
Through the co-chairs, Representative Suits, yes, you're talking about low-lead fuel, and we have some relief on that. We'll see how long. We're still fighting for it, of course. This is where they say the old airplanes come to die, and we use aviation just tremendously, and these smaller aircraft fit on a lot of our airfields.
Follow up.
So can you tell me what the change is that they're in the fuel that is coming and that we've got the exemption for, and how difficult that's going to be, and how it's going to affect the older planes that we have here?
Sure. Through the co-chairs, Representative Stutes, we're unclear yet. We were able to buy a little bit more time to use this low-lead fuel as we're trying to engineer new fuel additives or alternatives. We know that lead is bad for the environment, but we also know that if we can't get our milk or our medicine, we're in trouble as well. So we're always kind of weighing these things out.
And we have a question from Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the chair, just to build on Rep. Stutes' question related to leaded avgas. So last year, our House of Representatives passed the HJR 29 just to help with that extension for the EPA avgas ruling. But I know that, you know, I look back into the supporting documents for that, and the FAA had a few different recommendations for airports. So, you know, trying to find a cost-neutral alternative to leaded avgas is one of the suggestions, but I was looking at a few other recommendations, such as increasing the distance for your like maintenance or run up, decreasing idle time, just having more education for your pilots in airports. So I'm curious if you're pursuing any of those other mechanisms to at least help decrease the amount of lead emissions from avgas.
Through the co-chairs, Representative Mina, I believe that there's a lot of those discussions happening with the Alaska air carriers and industry. It's not necessarily statewide aviation that's driving it, but of course we're supporting them.
Thank you.
Great. I just want to note before we continue, we're going to go till 2:15 probably at the latest with this presentation before we switch topics. So I'd like to maybe get through some of the rest of the slides and then take questions at the end of the presentation.
I can pedal faster.
You're doing great.
All right.
I can't hear faster.
I can't understand acronyms faster, Mr. LaRue, so you're doing awesome.
Just through the co-chairs, forgive me for the acronyms again. So we look at our equipment needs, and right now, if we were to have $67 million, we would definitely spend it on equipment if we could afford to do that. Our immediate, what we have programmed this year is $7.7 million. In the next few years, we're hoping to actually bump up to $48 million. I don't know if that's realistic or not. We're thinking that 7.7 may be what we're able to do here for a few years. So if you divide that into 67 million, you know, we've got 9 years before we're going to be able to catch up. Now, the other things that we're doing is we're trying to look at some of the low-hour equipment that may be out in some of the other remote areas, and can we swap those out? I know that state equipment fleet is also looking at maybe refurbishing some of the older low-hour equipment that could be redistributed again. So I can tell you that the slow rollouts of grants, the lead time to get equipment these days is really, really tough, and we're not able to get Buy America waivers these days either, so we have to conform. So the cost of a grader, you can see, has increased over the last 10 years by 22%. The cost of an aircraft firefighting truck has increased by 61%, and then crushed aggregate is off the map. So it's really tough. Acronyms again. So our challenges today, this is the Dutch Harbor Airport. This is the airport that I started my career on. I started in 1997 after my father retired as the airport manager due to nepotism. We couldn't work together. But the warming climate and the high tides will push gravel up on the runway. That's the edge line that you're seeing there on that runway. And I can tell you I was grading some big rock off this runway one time, and I thought the event was over. Next thing you know, I had this huge rock that landed in the circle of my grader. And I realized I was driving a glass house at that point in time, and closed the runway and went and parked until we were sure that the event was over. But you guys have seen the freezing rain and the ice events and the weather increasing. Nome and Kotzebue, I mean, Kotzebue was underwater this year. It was awful. But due to a lot of really dedicated people, the airport wasn't closed for very long. You know, there was 6 inches of water in the terminal, and the next day they had passengers. So it just shows how resilient a lot of people are in Alaska. And then some of the solutions to our challenges, of course, are chemical and de-icing programs. And really, the weather instrumentations that are going on the roadways now, as well as our airports, are helping us with weather modeling, which is really good to be able to forecast issues as they're coming. And then as the permafrost is melting and we're looking for new surface stabilization solutions, it's pretty amazing what the engineers are coming up with today. So I'm optimistic. So attracting equipment operators, mechanics, and electricians are really, really tough these days, especially electricians. A lot of people don't want to go out when it's 10 below out and try to dig up a fault in the ground and fix a runway wire. And, you know, finding those people and then training them up is really, really tough. We have had some really broad recruitment efforts, and that has really helped us with recruitment and retention. Also, having more of a flexible work schedule. So if you could work week on, week off, or two on, two off, that makes a big difference to a lot of people. And if they know that they're going to get a little time off, they don't mind working that hard. We had mission critical incentive pay until this last round of union negotiations, and right now we're able to recruit in the rural aviation system without it. I don't know if that's going to last forever. And then we've contracted for services locally where we haven't been able to in the past. So,
Representative Stutes. Can I ask a couple questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the indulgence. Do you have any comparison as to what the pay scale is working for the state as opposed to private industry for the same comparable type of employment?
Through the co-chairs, Representative Stutes, you know, I have some thoughts in my own head, but I don't have any real data to share with you, unfortunately. So some of our other challenges are aging light systems, harsh Arctic climate, and vandalism has been one of them that we've actually curbed a little bit lately. I'm eager to see how this winter pans out, but once again, we're optimistic. We're focused right now. The commissioner's looking at some of our aging lighting systems, and he's like, I want you to prioritize these things and get them fixed. So we do have 10 lighting programs that we're trying to launch here as soon as humanly possible. The other thing that has happened is we've got a new line on emergency lighting kits for these airports, and they're considerably cheaper than the old ones were, which is really nice as well. So, and then training and public outreach has really been a help to us too. When you go into a community and you say, this is your lifeline, and we need to make sure that we protect our runway lights in our airport, and you talk about how important it is for the elders or anybody with a medical issue to be able to get in and out of the community, it does help with a perspective from a lot of folks. And there may be someone still ornery out there that wants to break a runway light, but we're hoping that peer pressure is going to keep them from doing it.
And Mr. LaRue, we have a question from Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Yeah, so I know 5-6 years ago vandalism was significant, $1.2 million, something like that. So it'd be interesting to see if it has gone down with your new program of talking to the folks. And it seems to be it's mostly teenagers out having fun in a baseball bat and a 3- or 4-wheeler and, you know, taking aim at the lights. And it costs us money, and you're exactly right. It's a safety issue for the folks that live in the village if they need to get out. So anyways, it would be great to see if that's gone down versus, you know, since you started the outreach thing.
Through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, yeah, we can get you those numbers. I believe it's cut in half.
Nice. Perfect.
So the last thing I wanted to share is a little bit about our unmanned aircraft systems and advanced air mobility. As you look at advanced air mobility in the lower 48, they're talking flying cars and vertiports and that sort of thing. Advanced air mobility to the state of Alaska is improving the safety of the airspace for all airspace users. So, believe it or not, we have now this very dangerous airspace. We have more registered drones in the airspace than we do conventional manned aircraft. So we have some pretty busy, dangerous airspace that has even become more congested. One of the things that we were able to do recently is the first stage of SMART grant. This is a U.S. DOT SMART grant that is designed to improve technology in any state. So the first stage was a short window of time, 18 months, and you had to prove out in that 18 months your concept, and then you were eligible for the second phase. These are zero match grants, and they are really technology-based. Let's harness technology, and let's do something different. You're going to look at an acronym in there, BVLOS. That's Beyond Visual Line of Sight. And we are one of the first states that were able to do a lot of missions that were beyond visual line of sight. We now have drone in docks in Thane Road and other locations to where an aircraft operator, a drone operator, can operate from any city, anywhere. We put up a traffic restriction so people can't fly through that airspace, and we're able to monitor avalanche chutes and landslides and that sort of thing. But with this grant, the first part of it, Alaska Rural Remote Operations Work Plan ARRO, we were able to go into 11 underserved communities, Bethel and around Bethel. We were able then to teach those people within the communities how to harness drone operations. And I'd have a video to show this, but my video won't play, so I'm explaining it. but basically, these 11 individuals were provided ESRI credits, which are credits that are ESRI is a mapping company. And so when these folks have been able to learn how to map their tribal trails and their roads and that sort of thing, now they can count injuries and deaths, and it opens up tribal transportation dollars for them. So we'll be able to partner with them in the future on transportation projects within their communities. We did complete the first round, and we're just getting ready to sign the grant now for the second SMART grant, which is worth $12.4 million. We believe that the drone and the dock systems are really the future and what needs to be deployed. And what's really nice about these systems is the drone is always warm, charged up, and ready to go. And so if the people in the community are using them and utilizing them for their own resource needs, that's great. But what we're able to do as well is we're able to then fly that drone if we believe that there's an issue that we need to be able to go look at. And anybody that has an operating agreement for that drone dock system would be able to do the same thing. But recently, with the storms that are happening, these operators are able to live stream the video from their drone straight to the governor's office or my office or your smartphone, and the governor can declare an emergency immediately now, where it might have taken 2 weeks to have the weather just to send somebody out to assess the damage. So extremely great program. And that's where my video was going to be. And thank you. I had Judy Chapman's information up here, too, because she's the Deputy Director of Planning and Program Development. And I was hoping to drag her here with me today, but unfortunately that didn't happen.
Thank you so much, Director LaRue, for that great presentation. We'll take a few questions. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I want to go back to the grader slide. Cost of the grader, $375,000 and up to $459,000. So how much of that cost is transportation? So let's say getting a new grader to Akiak or Carla, you know, some of those really remote runways that we have to have for Essential Air Service or whatever, bypass mail. So how much of that cost is transportation, or is that eaten up in another fund?
Yeah, through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, what we try to do is we try to schedule those deliveries with airfield projects, either at that airport or close to that airport, so that we could utilize a transportation link that's already being paid for and receive a lower amount. Now, does that always happen? No. Sometimes it's extremely expensive, but I don't think that the percentage is inflated due to transportation.
Thanks.
Mr. LaRue, I'll get folks in the queue. I'm going to put myself in the queue. I'm curious about mission critical incentive pay. Was that uniform across all of our rural aviation system employees?
Through the co-chairs, Representative Kirk, no, it wasn't. You know, we had to demonstrate that we were having recruitment issues in order to use that mission critical incentive pay. And where we were having recruitment issues, it did help us. I believe that a lot of our workforce did appreciate how hard everybody worked to receive some increases during this last collective bargaining agreement. Is it enough? I don't think it's ever enough, especially if you're in a rural setting. But it was what we were able to do.
And as a follow-up, was it airport-specific or employee-type-specific? Like, can you give a little bit of information about who
I believe
it?
That there were others other than airports. I just can't tell you because I don't have that knowledge. But I was hearing that we had some electricians and some other folks on mission critical pay as well.
Okay, Great, thank you. I'll comment that we were able to achieve parity with the Anchorage International Airport in Fairbanks for some of our employees and get mission critical incentive pay, and it did make a big difference for recruitment. So I'm glad to have seen that program when you needed it. I have Representative McCabe and then Co-Chair Eichheit.
So thank you. Through the Co-Chair, I forgot my second question on the greater slide is the aircraft rescue and firefighting. So those are only required at the 26 Part 139 airports?
Through the Co-Chair, Representative McCabe, correct.
Thanks.
The 26
airports. Maybe.
Representative Stutz, you want to ask that again?
Well, I just would like a clarification on what those airports are. Would you say the 26 and something else?
Through the co-chairs, Representative Stutz, these are the Part 139 airports that have over 30 passenger seats serving those airports that then require aircraft rescue firefighting.
Thank you.
All right. Co-Chair Eichheit, and then I think we'll probably wrap up the presentation at that point.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the chair. First of all, just a fascinating presentation. Thank you. I'm not a pilot, but I think I'd like to be a pilot. And so just listening, I'm very stimulated by this conversation. So just thank you for your service. The equipment needs on slide 18, you were talking and about, you know, some of the challenges. So the long lead time, then Buy American waivers. Can you just explain that program? I've heard of it, but, you know, I couldn't answer a quiz question on it yet.
Sure. Through the co-chairs, Representative Eichheit. So Buy America has been strictly enforced for many years, and there was a period of time, especially during the pandemic, where we were having extreme challenges getting equipment and materials and whatnot. We were able to execute some Buy America waivers at that point in time, which really gave us some relief, but that program is over.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions from committee members? All right. I want to thank you again, Director LaRue. That was a really great presentation and discussion. And at this point, we're going to take about a 5-minute at ease to exchange presenters and let everybody get a chance to get ready for the next presentation. At ease.
Thank you much.
All right, House Transportation Committee is back on the record, and at this time we've switched presentations. We are resuming our discussion from Tuesday of this week on the statewide transportation improvement program funds and process timeline. I'll have Catherine Keith, our deputy commissioner, come forward, as well as our director, Don Pannone. And it was my belief that I think we ended about slide 17 of this presentation. And so if we could perhaps begin there, but members may feel free to ask questions on any part of the presentation.
For the record, my name is Catherine Keith, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And with me is Director Pannone. If you could introduce yourself.
My name is Director Don Pannone, Director of Program Management and Administration for the Department of Transportation.
Okay, thank you. Well, thanks again to the co-chairs for inviting the department back to talk a little bit further about our statewide transportation improvement program. It's really great that we were able to take some time to learn more about where our rural statewide aviation is, and our Mr. LaRue is fantastic advocate for aviation across the state. And one thing just to mention that we didn't get to take much time for in the presentation was just the amount of innovation that's coming out of that part of the department that extends above and beyond what we'd expect with traditional rural airports. So when the mention is there of dashboards, what is happening right now with unmanned aerial systems and that advanced air mobility space is really exciting and putting Alaska on the cutting edge of in that airspace field. So something perhaps later, if the committee's interested, can hear more about. Well, that being said, we can focus on surface transportation. And I think this slide kicks us off where we talk a little bit about project delivery. And if the co-chairs allow, there was a particular slide a little bit earlier just talking through some of the corrective actions from the federal planning findings. And that might be a good opportunity to talk to just what the department has done as part of those corrective actions. Because I do want to comment that while we've been talking a lot about our concerns over interpretations of regulations that our Attorney General's office haven't concurred with, we have taken them to heart and incorporated that into our practices. So would you like to go back and talk about those or start here and move forward from this slide?
Let's go ahead and go back there, Deputy Commissioner, but we would like to get through the slide deck today, so as long as we are able to do that, that would be good.
We can cover this briefly. But yes, as a result of these findings, we have worked very collaboratively with Federal Highways, Federal Transit Administration, the Alaska Railroad, our metropolitan planning organizations, and other stakeholders across the state to look at these one by one. At the last hearing, we talked a little bit about urban area boundaries. And as a positive result of that, we've done a lot of work with GIS mapping. So we've been able to overlay, you know, previous boundaries, look into the current boundary, and be able to pinpoint where there are some areas to continue working on with our metropolitan planning organizations. The policy boards are working through that census update for 2026. And yeah, well, we certainly have some areas that we're not we're not 100% on. Those are ongoing conversations that'll likely take over the next 6 months to work through.
Co-chair Eyscheid has a question.
Thank you, Madam Co-chair. Through the co-chair, Deputy Commissioner Keith, so you know, I've done some reading on this topic of boundaries, mm-hmm. urbanized boundaries. Again, lots of acronyms. But, you know, going back to my co-chair's area, Fairbanks, the FAST MPO. So I'm just familiar with this work from my Mat-Su Borough planning work. And, you know, every 10 years, of course, just to review it, we have the census. And then, you know, based on population, a designated urban area is the map is adjusted. Is that correct? I'm just making sure okay. So I think the Fairbanks area did that. They made their adjustments, went through that whole process, public comment, yada, yada, yada. And then I believe the process is once they have gone through that, then they submit that to the governor's office for approval. Can you tell me more about that? Because I don't know the whole history. I don't always trust everything I read. So has that been submitted to the governor's office, and what is the status of that?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Eyscheid. This is largely why we wanted to bring this up, just because there has been a lot of discourse on these topics. And there is a sequence of events that happens to get to final adoption of the 2020 census areas. Ultimately, these are approved by the governor by statute. And to get to the governor for approval, then that goes from our commissioner in coordination with our attorney general's office, who goes through these boundary changes. And together, we just need to ensure that when we submit something to the governor's office, that it is a legally sound document. And in both areas, AMATS in the Anchorage area, metropolitan area, and Fairbanks metropolitan area, there just are some areas that at the time of the initial evaluation, there were areas that just didn't get thoroughly addressed. So when documentation came to the department for final review, we needed to finish this consultation, like with Department of Natural Resources, for example, in the Anchorage area. Some of these are very minor, where we have GIS boundaries that are in the middle of like Richardson Highway, so it's not clear, like, does the... What, is it on both sides of the highway or just one side? So that's a really minor thing, but we just need to make sure when we update the language that it's very clear, especially when we've had some back and forth concern over, you know, the impact of being either within the metropolitan planning area or outside. So yeah, we're just going through these conversations. They will be ongoing for a while, a little bit longer, I expect. We hope to get through these conversations so that we can have adopted boundaries by the end of 2026 so that we stay in compliance.
Follow up? Yeah, so I just was curious, when were those materials submitted to the state for the governor's approval? You know, I understand there's an iterative process of some sort, but I'm just wondering, when did the governor's office administration receive that? I'm just kind of just trying to understand how long things take.
Yeah, Co-Chair Eichheid, they have not been submitted to the governor's office, the materials either for the AMATS area or the Fairbanks metropolitan area, because we're still working out these specifics with the boundaries. So as soon as we have concurrence on the boundaries so that they are clear, and not just with the State Department of Transportation, but other agencies as well, including Department of Natural Resources, I can elaborate on. In the Anchorage area, there, for example, the boundary is incorporating, the proposed boundary is incorporating Chugach State Park. And the extended boundaries, the requirement for inclusion is the 2020 new expanded urban area and any area that will have a population increase within 20 years, enough that it would then be considered or designated an urban area. So therefore, including Chugach State Park, which will not have a urban area classification within 20 years, that is not an area that would be included for surface transportation development. So it's a pretty simple change, but again, just having this conversation. And to answer your original question, when did that get submitted to the department? It could be approximately a year, perhaps 9 months ago. I can find the exact date when that came to the department. Since then, we've requested to be on the technical committee and policy boards to talk through both the boundary change and the operating agreement and the timing of how that occurs amongst the statewide transportation improvement program has not lined up where we can dig deep into these conversations.
Just a comment.
Follow-up comment?
I had read November of 2023. It was, you know, from the FAST thing. So I just, that's what I was looking for, is just, you know, understanding the process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Co-Chair. So through the Co-Chair, I have a couple of questions, if that's okay, especially on the boundary. So first off, the way I understood it, and I was a little bit involved with the initial forming of the MATSU MPO, I'm a little disappointed, too, that they weren't here to testify the other day or today or any time. I'd really like to hear from them because that's my district, right? I was under the understanding that it was the general population of the area on a certain census was over 100,000, you get this smaller MPO. But the boundaries are determined differently, not necessarily by population, but by things such as stormwater drainage and runoff and that sort of thing. So I'm curious, I guess my big question is, how are the MPOs determining their own boundaries? How are they keeping track of them? And when they modify them, does it need a reapproval by the governor? Does it need so in other words, if Fairbanks Fast did their boundaries in November 23rd, one would think that the governor would need to sign and the mayor would need to sign a new agreement with new boundaries. And I'm curious if that happened, how they did it, where we can go to see it, where we can go to find it, because, all this has sort of happened. I'll tell you right now, and I'll tell the public, none of this would have happened if there hadn't been Moncho Trucking, period. We wouldn't even be having this conversation on the STIP. None of this would have happened. So the politics of this are frustrating, to say the least, and I want the public to be able to know where they can go to find MPO boundaries and who changed them and if the governor and the mayor signed them and that sort of thing. So can you maybe flesh that out a bit for us? And frankly, what the boundaries are, what determines the actual boundaries?
Through the co-chair, Representative McCabe. Yeah, these are certainly nuanced conversations, and you're happy to expand as much as possible on those. On any boundary change within a metropolitan planning area, that does absolutely require a signature by a governor at the time, in this case, Governor Dunleavy. We have been working historically to make sure we have documentation required by our stewardship and oversight agreement of previous governor approvals, and we're still working to get these documentations over the years of any changes. With even an operating agreement change, as that's an agreement with the state and the metropolitan area, that also requires a governor's signature. So these are, very regulated processes. When a boundary area is determined, that is a public process where there has been a lot of coordination in all three of our metropolitan planning areas, and it should be based on the census data, the updated census data, as that happens every 10 years, and then focusing on those expanded urban areas. That being said, or potentially or forecasted urban areas. However, it can be proposed that there are areas where there's connections. So say, for example, as in the Fairbanks area, Eielson Air Force Base was considered part of the urban area boundary. And so part of the proposed boundary is a connection between the current Fairbanks Metropolitan Planning Area and then Eielson. So there is a corridor there of a proposed boundary. And that's partly where the confusion went back and forth with the Richardson Highway milepost 346 bridges, is because of that proposed but not yet approved recommended boundary change. Does that answer your question fully, Representative McCabe?
So maybe this will help. So I heard last year that the and over the interim, frankly, that the Fairbanks, the FAST technical committee indefinitely tabled their discussion, their operating agreement with the state over this. Was it over their attempts to expand their boundaries and the state not agreeing? Or maybe you could flesh that out as well a little bit for us.
Yeah, through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, as a result of the clarification from Federal Highways of the department's responsibility for stewardship and oversight over the metropolitan planning organizations, and to reiterate, that means that we are responsible for the certification of the transportation improvement programs and other aspects of the metropolitan planning organizations. So that being said, we have focused a lot on documentation, including making sure that the operating agreements are in compliance with state statute and federal law. And in addition to that, that the boundaries are updated and are thorough, so that 5 years from now, whoever is with all of these organizations can clearly understand where the boundaries are. So when the boundary change was initiated, with the assumption of authority that the MPOs had taken with their efforts to remove national highway system projects from the area. The department and our state Department of Law recommended that the operating agreement be updated at the same time as the boundary change was recommended to the governor for approval. So it could be, and I don't want to presume the motivation behind that action, but yes, the technical committee in the Fairbanks area, of which we do have Department of Transportation staff, did vote to indefinitely postpone any conversations of the operating agreement in the future. So that is not action the policy board has taken as of now, and we're having ongoing conversations with the policy board. But that is a problem for us by state statute and federal regulation. It's a requirement that we periodically review and update our operating agreements, just as is, you know, kind of common sense to make sure it's clear how we are operating between our organizations.
One more follow-up, if you don't mind. Thank you. So I know from last year that the DOT has been attending every single meeting. You haven't missed, as far as I know, and I even checked during the interim, you haven't missed a meeting when you've been there, and I really appreciate that. So I have a really, really simple question. If this continues to be a problem, can the governor dissolve this whole MPO thing? I'm unclear how. You know, it's like a partnership. When you get into a partnership, one of the things you have to do in your partnership agreement is have a way to get away from each other. So is there a way inside the MPO agreement that the governor can dissolve the MPO with the Fairbanks FAST?
Through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, the requirement for Metropolitan Planning Organization or any urban designation, it's a federal regulation including in some of our state statutes, that these metropolitan planning areas exist and that we collaborate, which is a requirement, we collaborate on projects within that metropolitan area. So no, the governor of a state would not have the authority to disband a metropolitan planning organization. As of this time, it's required for populations over 50,000.
So sounds like they kind of have us over the barrel.
Through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, we absolutely need to abide by our 3C process and ideally, through some of our new practices, just continue to improve in our conversations about how we don't get into the situation moving forward.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would respond to Representative McCabe's comments. The federal regulations have us over a barrel if you see the MPOs as an obstacle here rather than a partner. I want to make sure we get to looking ahead and what the impacts of the STIP process thus far have been. I'm wondering if we might be able to skip ahead back to slide 17 and moving forward, seeing as we only have about 25 minutes left today.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And for the record, this is Catherine Keith. We have several slides here talking about project delivery, and that is one thing that we've been focusing very heavily on, is ensuring that we have a pipeline of projects that allows us to ensure a healthy contracting community that addresses the needs across the state. And that this is a positive outcome of our efforts with Federal Highways, because while the STIP is not the only factor for project delivery, there are several other barriers that we're experiencing right now. It is one that preludes our funding. With respect to our healthy contracting, what you can see on the slide are two items. The one on the left is our obligations every year for our federal funds. And I'll point out that this includes both Federal Aviation Administration and Federal Highways Administration funds. And you'll see that the difference from federal fiscal year 22 to federal fiscal year 24 is that in 24 there is a lower amount I'll note, too, that in federal fiscal year 21, it was relatively on the same line as this last fiscal year. And this is, I would say, a normal fluctuation for us. This last year, as part of our August redistribution process, we had less August redistribution, which is additional contract authority from the Federal Highways Administration that allows us to spend more of our revenue than we usually do in a given year. So what this means is that while we did have less obligations this last year, we had already programmed our easily available flexible funding in these previous years, which we focus very heavily on. Largely what remains for this next year, where you'll see us focusing very heavily, is in the Metropolitan Planning Organization areas. In the Anchorage area itself, there's about $88 million that will need to be obligated this year that will help us increase our overall obligation. With contract awards themselves, you see that they are on a declining trajectory. And for us, that was also expected. It was intentional that we get caught up on projects that were already out on the street and underway. We had several new starts, many new starts within this period. However, we were way over-programmed, as I mentioned earlier. So we wanted to get caught up with projects that were multi-year projects. And so part of these awards takes that into account. Another item that they don't reflect is that we have projects that are using construction manager, general contractor method of procurement. Those have been awarded, but we won't see the construction portion of those projects, including Kotzebue to Cape Blossom Road and the Richardson Highway Chena bridges that we've been discussing. Those went out for award earlier, but they won't be reflected here until we move into actual construction obligation. There's several fact indexes here. My background has a lot of project management and agile project certification, so personally I love this stuff with earned value management. And so this is just to point out, we do have a project management office now at the department. These are items that we're going to be continuing to track regularly to help forecast moving forward what our pipeline of projects is. And this will help us understand, you know, when there are concerns within the contracting community, what we do need to change course with, if we do at all. This will transition a little bit into active project execution. The prior slide had a lot to do with project readiness, going through making sure we have a proper disbursement of projects. And on this slide, we get into payments that contractors are being provided with, or payments that are going out to complete the construction projects. You can see that these were increasing. So while our contract awards themselves were decreasing, that's because we had very active projects with a major upward swing in these contractor payments. In this case, we're talking about this program balance. And so that's that comparison between what's being awarded for contracts versus what we're currently paying out every year. And that's what we want to keep an eye on. And this is something that, you know, we recognize that there's that declining pipeline if it was left unaddressed. That being said, this year we're expecting a very high level of contract awards as we have new starts happening now as a result of these multi-year projects going down. So for us, we are looking at this overall balance, and we're balancing our pay down of advanced construction, which Director Pannone will talk about here in a moment. But we feel very confident that our construction program is very healthy and robust, and look forward, though, to collaborating more with our contracting community on concerns that they have and ways to mitigate any impacts that they are currently expressing about our delivery program. And so that gets us to what we were just talking about with funding sustainability. We want to ensure, not just for this year, but in years ahead, we're setting up the delivery teams for success by having a balanced fund program with the interest in having increased transportation projects on the street. The only way for us to do that is to leverage this advanced construction or to take a loan out on future dollars. But we do have to pay that back. So if we took out a major increase, which is something that we're very open to discussing, that would mean a decrease in available revenue for projects in years to come. Director Pannone, you want to talk about this slide and August redistribution, if there's anything else to add?
For the record, Dom Pannone, Director of Program Management. So our advanced construction balance, it is not actually expenses incurred. It is authorized projects that we've allowed to go forward with an agreement with our federal partner and then use future funds, future years funding, to convert those to being fully obligated federal funds. So we use that as a tool, and that can accelerate in time our project delivery, or as we pay that back down, decelerate the amount of projects that are in the pipeline. And as the Deputy Commissioner said, some of those projects can have multi-year contractor payment periods. So the advanced construction balance, or really the authorizations we have, are another lens in which we use to monitor the pipeline of project delivery. Going to the next slide, this is talking about August redistribution. And this slide shows for several states here the last 10 years of August redistribution. Over the last 10 years, Alaska has been very successful at using August redistribution and the additional spending authority that comes along with it. You can see we've outdone several other states that are far larger in population and federal funding. You can also see Hawaii has had 2 years where they've had zero August redistribution, and some states have had a pattern where their pipeline has not allowed them to utilize August redistribution. Essentially, what August redistribution is the state is entitled to a certain amount of funding every year, and then as the year progresses, the federal government releases the authority to spend those funds. And at the end of the year, they will release additional authority from other programs, other discretionary type programs that are unused by all the states. That allows us to access more of our funds if we have the projects available. So we work with our federal partner at the state level, the state office, to come up with a plan to accelerate projects with the additional spending authority. The funding that does not get accessed through that additional spending authority rolls over to the next year, and as August redistribution completes, we roll into the next federal year and continue with project delivery. When we're trying to put together a plan for project delivery, we're limited to the specific funds that have remaining balances. There's over 65 federal funds from federal highways that we manage. And as the Deputy Commissioner said, a large portion of the rollover from last year that we are looking to use this year is within the AMATS MPA.
So I have a question as well. I'll ask and then turn it over to Representative Stutes. So it looks like Alaska is comparable this year with approximately 2014-2015 levels of August redistribution. So two questions. What was the amount that we applied for August redistribution? And then how do we account for the delta between $20 million, it looks like, approximately, compared to last year's $110 million? That's an incredible loss to the state of Alaska.
So, Madam Co-Chair, excellent question. So the amount that we applied for was $71.4 million, and the amount we received was $19.2 million, compared to last year's $108 million. I would state that Alaska has not lost those funds. They carried over. We did not accelerate the projects in the prior federal fiscal year. And largely what our focus on is having more projects ready to deliver and having the right kinds of projects that can use up the funds. So as we go, several of our fund sources are for multi-year periods, and as we deliver projects that use those specific funds, we can be left with specific fund types that are only applicable to the projects that can use those. And August redistribution is a matter of matching up those projects, having them ready to deliver at that point in time in the last couple months of the year. So, Deputy Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you, Director Pannone. And so to answer, or just to highlight a couple points to sort of punctuate them, because this has been in the media quite a bit that we've lost out on funding coming into the state. And yes, that is absolutely not true. There is authority that we receive, just like with our state legislative authority. And that authority is what we were seeking to spend some of these additional funds. But the funding that we had, this revenue that has carried over to this year, it was in these discrete fund sources. So when we get asked the question, why didn't this funding going to projects like Cooper Landing Bypass, which is a project that we're all eager to get underway, that requires this National Highway System funding. It's flexible National Highway Performance Program funding. Also, we could use surface transportation block grant funds. But aside from that, we're limited. And those funds, those revenue sources, were used in nearly their entirety. So we didn't have any of those left to fund that project. What we had was carbon reduction, some protect, some congestion mitigation, air quality funds. And so those are the ones that are pretty strange with eligibilities that we watch carefully that we're developing a program for this summer. But just to comment on, like, these funds could not have been spent on the National Highway System, Cooper Landing Bypass Project, and the department did not lose out on funding.
Mm-hmm. Well, follow up.
Yeah.
The delta between what we applied for and what we received is far greater than any recent year, even according to this chart. So I guess that's me editorializing, yeah. And I apologize. It's a really sensitive subject for the Fairbanks area. Representative Stutes.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. That was kind of the direction I was going to. And then you're talking about the Cooper Landing. Good grief, that's been 8 years ago that project started, if I'm correct. That was Representative Chenault was pushing that through. How can there not be funds for that when that is an ongoing project for 8 years, and to say there was no funds left over here, but we have funds left over here? I know it's me. You're familiar with what you're saying, but I'm not remotely familiar with what you're saying, so I'm not understanding. I don't understand what you said.
Yeah, through the co-chairs, Representative Stutes. Yeah, thank you. I'll try to clarify as best I can. Understanding, yes, this does get nuanced. With Cooper Landing Bypass, yeah, this project goes back decades with pre-construction activities, and we are eager to get this underway. When we looked at our budget a couple of years ago as part of this, as we were pulling together our STIP 2024 to 2027, we refreshed a lot of the cost estimates, and this was a project whose costs had a massive increase, where the original budget for Cooper Landing Bypass was approximately $400 million. We can provide the committee with these exact amounts. There was a recently updated financial plan. That increased to, I believe, over $800 million at this point. And in previous years, we didn't actually use revenue or real dollars for this project. This project used advanced construction. So as part of our program in the next few years, we've been trying to balance out new construction for the project with the advanced construction. And our approach was to make sure we got the bridge built, which is a substantial project. And when that's complete, which right now is projected to be fiscal year 27, then we'll continue building the remainder of it. But we have obligated a substantial portion of the 4 years to this project. And another challenge that we had, which goes to answer your question, that was a major part of our national highway system funding. We get approximately $350 to $370 million through our national highway system funding. That's all we get. So when we have one project that could take up 3 years of our program, essentially, that would all go to one contractor. Therefore, all of the other contractors, the Alaska-based contractors, they would not have any opportunity to bid on projects. And so part of this decision-making was to ensure that we had a distributed construction community and that they didn't have concerns with, you know, kind of what we're hearing now, where they're concerned they're losing business and having trouble, which I believe you'll have the opportunity to hear more about. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you for that. So now, can you explain, so I can understand, the discrepancy between the amount of dollars that were applied for and the amount of dollars that were actually, make it simple, like I'm a second grader, because that's what you need to do for this particular situation.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, when the notice of additional spending authority comes out, we have to work with our federal partner to agree on a plan that is with absolute certainty with us and the Alaska Federal Highway Office that we can deliver all these projects. We submitted a plan for the approximately $70 million, and we did not agree, the state DOT and federal highways, on which projects could be delivered with certainty. And there were disagreements related to the STIP, some of our estimates, and some of our schedules. Some of those projects did go forward, and that led... The disagreement on what DOT could deliver led to the reduction in the authority in the ultimate award of August redistribution.
Follow up?
Thank you. I'm getting there. Thank you. So, through the chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Essentially, the state said, we can finish all these projects by this time, and the Fed said, no, we don't think you can, so we're not going to give you the money. Is that pretty much in a nutshell?
Through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, the state said we think we can deliver these projects, and our federal partner had concerns and ultimately didn't agree, correct?
Thank you.
All right. I see a question. I'm just going to make sure that the folks that haven't yet asked questions today in the committee don't want a chance to chime in, because this will probably be our last question. Representative McKee.
Thanks. So, I do have a question. I got a lot of questions, but how much input are to our federal highway partners in their decision to stop the August plus-up funding or the redistribution? How much of their decision do you think was driven by comments from, say, FAST or AMATS or outside influence influencing the Federal Highway Administration? I know that's a very political question, but I suspect that there is a little bit of influence going on, a little bit of politics going on, and that's the reason, really, in a nutshell, that our August redistribution was smaller. Kevin's suspicion is all but...
Through the co-chairs, Representative McCabe, there were projects within the August redistribution plan that were within the metropolitan planning area. And because of the new practices, what I can say did happen was that projects that didn't have to before be listed on the transportation improvement program that were in our August redistribution plan were not able to go forward. And this included some of our highway safety improvement program funds. So it may be the new practices, things that we weren't used to reviewing for August redistribution were applied to this. But I wouldn't be able to speak to the direct communication between those two entities. I can say we are already working with Federal Highways on this year's August redistribution, of which we have been received a memo from the headquarters, Federal Highways, that will be eligible for up to $126 million. So I can promise that we are very, very eager to capture all of that authority and use up the available revenue that we have, even in these hard to obligate funds. That is a commitment, and we are working together with our partners so that we can all be proud and be very high up on the August redistribution list this year.
Thanks. It would be helpful if they would actually have a meeting and come together and be a good partner instead of an adversary.
Okay. is there any other comment from the committee? I will say there's some semantics differences here that are functionally important. MPO organizations are not outside influence per federal regulation. They are partners in the conversation. There seems to be a lot of back and forth, but I think the ultimate takeaway that I have gotten from this presentation is that our state has, whether the semantic is did not receive or missed out on, we do not have shovel-ready projects in the millions of dollars scale that we might have otherwise been able to obtain. Are there any last comments from committee members? Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm excited for the AMHS presentation. Thank you.
We had a great day on rural aviation as well.
Can I say one?
Representative McCabe and then Co-Chair Eichheit, and then we really will have to wrap up here.
So thanks. I am just wondering when the advocates for safe highways are going to look at the Parks Highway and the transportation of interior gas utility liquid natural gas in those big, huge tankers all the way 500 miles up the Parks Highway to Fairbanks. They're very concerned about the Moncho trucking, and I wanted on the record that there are those of us in Big Lake, Willow, Houston, Talkeetna, Trapper Creek, all the way up the highway that are just as concerned with the interior gas utility trucks that go up the Parks Highway. Both of them are public federal highways. Both of them have public money coming to them, and they both deserve to be able to have commercial trucking on them. So I'm just wondering when the advocates for safe Alaska highways are going to engage on the interior gas utility trucks.
Well, I can't speak for them, Representative McCabe, but I could certainly invite them to come and
that would be
present with us.
Thing. Thank you.
Co-Chair Eichheit.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. Just, if I could just give a comment. So I appreciate your service and your presentation. That last part was super hard for me to understand, and as a science person, I'd like to think I have a grasp of math. So, there was that expression many years ago about fuzzy math. That was very fuzzy for me. So I think it behooves DOT to be a little more clear with the public because, people out there just, they see numbers from 70 million to 19 million. It looks like a decrease, and we have a lot of construction jobs. Roads are really important in House District 22. It's the third most common thing people said at my door. So I just I hope we can meet again and maybe flesh this out just so it's a little more clear for me and the public. I think that's how you create confidence. But thank you for your service.
All right. I'm not seeing any further comments before the committee. Thank you for presenting and for the robust conversation from committee members. I think regardless of whether we agree or disagree on the current status of the STIP, discussion and debate is healthy and it's important. And I really appreciate everybody's engagement on this. So next week on Tuesday, February 4th, we will be meeting at slightly delayed time of 2 p.m. just for committee members' information here in room 124. And with no further business to come before our committee today, we will adjourn at 3:01 p.m.